Typically, identity politics are associated with marginalized groups, communities that have been defined as other by the dominant group in a political culture. Today's guest argues that there is an emerging white identity politics. She's Ashley Jardina this week on Story in the Public Square. And welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, filmmakers, scholars, journalists, and more, to make sense of the big stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Ashley Jardina, a professor of political science at Duke University, who is also the author of a new book titled White Identity Politics. Ashley, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's just start by unpacking what the title of your book is, White Identity Politics. What do each of those things mean in the context of your book?
Yeah, so what I'm interested in is understanding how many white Americans in the United States are responding to the U.S. becoming far more racially diverse than it was in the past. And so part of the phenomenon that I'm talking about and I'm uncovering is the fact that there are a sizable number of whites in the United States today who feel a sense of identity or attachment or solidarity with their racial group, and that solidarity matters for how they view the political world. So if we want to understand issues like attitudes towards immigration, attitudes towards certain social welfare benefits, and support for Donald Trump, then part of what underlies that is white identity politics.
And what is the, how do you measure white identity?
Yeah, so I use public opinion surveys, and in some ways it's very straightforward. I've got a long measure, but oftentimes I just ask people directly, how important is being white to your identity? And what I find is that about 30 to 40% of white Americans say that their racial identity is very, if not extremely, important to them.
And is that those numbers, do you have a longitudinal understanding of how that plays out?
To some extent. So it turns out that because social scientists thought that white identity didn't really matter very much, or they thought that it was invisible, we weren't asking questions on surveys about white identity until very recently. And so I go back as far as 2010 under the Obama administration, and I know really that actually levels of white identity, at least from 2010 till about 2016, haven't really changed very much. So my story is not about a rise in the level of white identity, it's about the activation of it and the extent to which it matters for politics.
So how do you and I guess your respondents define white? Can't white mean different things depending on where you live in the country, what your social circumstances are, what your economic circumstances are? How do you define that? I mean, it's a pretty broad term, it seems to me.
So everyone who is in my data and all the people I'm interested in on a survey indicate that they're non-Hispanic whites. And I think for a long time over the course of American history, we thought about white ethnic groups. We thought about Irish Americans and Italian Americans. But it turns out that really today, people have a pretty consistent understanding of what it means to be white. Those ethnic identities have largely faded in the public mind. And today, a lot of white people, at least the white people I'm interested in studying, really see a lot of commonality with fellow white people. And part of it is because it's in contrast with who they aren't. They aren't people of color. They're not black people. They're not Latinos. They're not Asian Americans. And so there is really the sort of consistent and commonality.
And is that commonality nationwide, or did you find regional differences? I mean, for example, we're taping at our flagship studio, Rhode Island PBS in Rhode Island. Would that not be different than just picking a state, Washington State or Alabama, realizing that those states also have a rather mixed composition of racial groups too? But you see my question. Let me get to the point.
Yeah.
Are there regional differences?
there aren't many regional differences. In fact, the place we'd probably most expect to see them would be in the South, right? So if we think about race and the legacy of race and the extent to which people sort of talk about race, then the South is often the place that social scientists go to look for racial differences. And certainly whiteness and thinking about white identity seems like it might have been really relevant in the South too. And I think that there probably is some truth to that. It's actually hard to uncover with public opinion data because there are so many people who have moved into the South. And we don't often ask people on our big social surveys, were you raised in the South? How long did you live there? And I suspect if we had more of those questions that we might find some differences with respect to South versus non-South. But really, if you look across the Northeast or the Pacific Northwest or even in the Midwest, there's actually a remarkable level of consistency with the extent to which people identify as white and think about themselves in this way. So there aren't merely many regional differences.
So how does white identity manifest itself? Leave the politics aside for right now. If we're talking about white identity, how does it manifest itself?
So to some extent, it's people feeling like they see themselves as being white. They think of their family members as being white. Their communities are white. They also tend to attach a lot of these sort of things that we think of as kind of part of American identity with being white. So they see themselves as mainstream Americans. If you ask them, you know, what do you associate with whiteness? They'll often talk about things like baseball and apple pie, these kind of very traditional symbols that we think about as being part of what it means to be an American. But they see those things as deeply associated with what it means to be white, too, which is what's interesting.
So let's get into the politics. White identity, we've talked about that. We're talking about white and identity. How does this affect politics? And both on the regional and sort of local level, you mentioned cities are becoming increasingly diverse, but also on the national level. So that's a lot of questions that I've given you this. Let's start on the regional or state level. How does that affect regional and state politics?
So to answer this question really well, I want to make an important distinction, and I want to kind of unpack what I mean by white identity politics from what we think of as racial prejudice, and because that's a really important component here. So social scientists have spent a lot of time trying to understand what white racial prejudice looks like. We've been thinking about this since the 1940s, coming out of World War II and Nazi Germany, and so when we've studied white racial attitudes generally, we've often been interested in what do white people think about people of color? And particularly in the United States, how do whites think about blacks? And so we spent a lot of time thinking about the animus or the hostility or the resentment or the negative stereotypes that some whites have toward these groups. And we think that that explains racial inequality. It explains why some white people support particular political candidates. We know it explains why they oppose a lot of policies that are meant to help achieve greater levels of racial equality in the United States. And so that's kind of the lens with which we've often thought about race and racial attitudes mattering. And what I'm arguing is that there's another force at play here now, one that wasn't necessarily always part or central to American politics, that's more episodic, but that some whites aren't motivated at all by a dislike for people of color. Instead, they're motivated and they see the political world as being about trying to protect their group and their status and the privileges that they get as part of being white. And so that means that when politicians at the state level or at the national level talk about wanting to limit immigration, talk about wanting to help white people, wanting to, you know, do things for particular groups, a lot of whites, in a way that they might not have been in previous years, are really responding to that. They like those politicians.
You know, there's a discordant quality to that in the sense that typically when we talk about identity politics, we've been talking about marginalized groups who have used identity politics to try to level the playing field. What is the sense of grievance that motivates white identity? Or the sense of loss that motivates white identity?
Well, exactly, it is. It's a sense of loss, and there are a number of things that we can point to, right? So for one, we know that because of immigration and demographic change, the whites are losing their numerical majority in the United States, and there's been a lot of news coverage about this, really, since
But numerical majority is different from losing rights.
Sure. But for a lot of whites, that's deeply symbolic. And it's indicative of the potential for whites to also lose out politically. And of course, you know, during this period of time in which we've seen massive immigration, we've seen demographic change, we've also seen these other consequences, right? The election of the nation's first black president, deeply symbolic for some whites of a shift in political power, right? For the first time, there's not a white person. There wasn't a white person who was president. And so a lot of these whites are worried that they are losing their numerical majority, that they're losing their political power and status, and that potentially, as the country becomes more diverse, that they're going to basically lose the privileges that whites have as a result of being the dominant group in the United States, of having a disproportionate share of power in economic and social and political resources.
Is that a universally held fear among the people you surveyed and have studied, as opposed to whites who might say, well, the nation is changing and I'm fine with that?
Yes.
It's the way it is. Actually, frankly, our country has always changed racial composition. You know, when we go back to the original inhabitants, the Native Americans.
Yeah. So whites who are high in white identity are far more likely than whites low on identity to be worried about the ethnic composition of the United States. They don't think that immigration is good for the country. And they're also worried that politicians who aren't white are going to do more for people of color than they're likely to do for white people. So for them, it really does seem to be about this legitimate, in their minds, sense of loss, right? And of course, the reality is that that's far from likely to be true, right? Even as the country becomes more diverse, it's highly unlikely that the disproportionate share of resources that whites have is going to markedly shift anytime soon. And that's part of why this is important, right? Because if we're interested in talking about racial equality, what's going on here is that a lot of these whites are really interested in frankly, preserving a system of racial inequality because they benefit from it.
So what are the sources of information for people who hold these views? I mean, we live in a social media age. We live in an age of fake news, quote unquote, and you know the age we live in. Where do these opinions form? Is it conversations with other people? Is it what they read, what they see on Facebook or Twitter, or where's it come from? I'm guessing a lot of different places.
Yeah, I mean, all of the above. You know, frankly, even mainstream media has been kind of ratcheting up these fears and anxieties. There's work that's demonstrated that when white people read about the census projections, that they're far more likely to bring the sense of racial identity to bear on their candidate evaluations. They're more likely to support politicians who they think are going to protect their group. They're more likely to become somewhat more politically conservative, even. And so it's not just sort of the usual suspects we think of as kind of peddling more conservative news or kind of ratcheting up the sense of grievance. It's mainstream media just sort of talking about these issues and highlighting them in a way that maybe they shouldn't or they don't need to be.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. And if you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Ashley Giardina, a professor of political science at Duke University. She's also the author of a new book titled simply White Identity Politics. You can find Ashley on Twitter at Ashley Giardina. That last name is Giardina. How does white identity politics link to, so I think about, there was a Vice News embed with some of the protesters in Charlottesville. When they talk a lot about defending their white race, yeah, and being pride in their white, having pride in their white identity. What is the relationship between what you're talking about and that part of sort of the white supremacist movement?
Yeah. This is a really important question. So first of all, the whites that I'm interested in, and we're talking about, again, 30 to 40% of the white American population, they certainly would not see themselves as members of the alt-right. I know that they reject some association with the KKK. The KKK is a deeply unpopular group among all white Americans. They're not members of the alt-right. They're not white supremacists. This is a far greater group. And there are a couple of things that make them different. So one is that the thing about white supremacists is that they are both very high in white identity and they score very high on our measures of racial prejudice, right? They're both of these things. But there are a lot of white people who don't have a strong sense of antipathy or animus or resentment toward racial and ethnic minorities, but nevertheless still have this sense of in-group favoritism, this sense of solidarity. They still want to protect their group. And so what that means is that they're not motivated by a dislike for people of color. But at the same time, I think what's troubling and worrying is that they still hold some of the same policy preferences right. and some of the beliefs of bona fide white supremacists. And so sometimes I think people turn to white identity politics and they see it as maybe this kind of innocuous force or just another group in the sort of host of groups in our country adopting an identity. And what I argue is that actually we should be concerned about this if what we're concerned about is racial inequality and racial conflict in the United States. Well,
and domestic tranquility.
Absolutely.
There's a long history, particularly in the European context, where political parties become aligned with ethno-national identities.
Right.
And that's a recipe for violence and bad things.
Yeah, exactly. Not
to put too fine a tooth on it. We talk about the election of Donald Trump in 2016, and a lot of commentators have said that he gave voice to the white working class and sort of channeled their insecurities. Does your research correlate with what you have found?
Yes, but with one caveat. So a lot of people think that the story about white identity politics is a story almost exclusively about the white working class. And it turns out that that's not true. That there are people who are across the income and occupation spectrums who possess this sense of identity. So it's not just limited to the white working class by any means. And so what that means is that there are a lot of white people who feel this sense of grievance, who share this concern. But what does sort of keep what the commonality that they do have is that people who are high in white identity were far more supportive of Donald Trump, and not just Donald Trump. So they weren't just interested in any Republican candidate. And part of that is because Trump really uniquely appealed to this subset of voters. And he did it in a couple ways. First of all, he began his campaign by focusing almost exclusively on immigration.
Right.
So one of the things I like to point out to people is if you go to Donald Trump's website in August of 2015, and you can do this, you can go to the Internet Wayback Machine, right?
Yep.
Exactly.
Great tool.
Yeah, and you can look at his website as it existed on the Internet then. And if you click on the link for policy positions, the only issue on his website was immigration reform. So he begins by talking about immigration. And then he parts ways from the traditional Republican Party platform by arguing that he's going to protect Social Security and Medicare. And this is interesting because these are policies that are uniquely associated with whiteness. And I'm not the first person to make this argument. Scholars like Nick Winter at the University of Michigan, Donald Kinder at the University of Michigan, they've been talking about how Social Security is, it sort of stands in contrast with welfare, which is associated with all of these disparaging and erroneous stereotypes about people of color and blacks in the United States. Social Security stands in contrast to that. It's a policy that we see as being for people who are working hard, a reward for doing everything right, doing things correctly. And so it's associated with whiteness. And it turns out that people who are high in white identity really like Social Security. So Trump comes along, he focuses on immigration, he focuses on Social Security, and then, you know, he says things like, we're going to make America great again. Yeah. He's got these kind of dog whistle appeals to this group. And so in some ways, he was perfectly strategic in a way that many of the other Republican frontrunners weren't.
Is that, when you think about the people who were around him at that point in the campaign, Steve Bannon was not, he was still on doing his radio show, but Stephen Miller was already involved, I think, in the campaign at that point. Is this something that was a conscious decision, do you think, by the Trump campaign to target this part of white identity?
I do, absolutely. I think that's true of most politicians over the course of history. If we think about the way that race has been used in political campaigns, politicians and political operatives tend to know exactly what they're doing.
And so, the
days before the president's rollout in Orlando for the 2020 cycle, he announced that there would be a big ICE crackdown and they were going to round up millions of undocumented immigrants and their families and deport them.
Right.
Are we going to see now the power of the U.S. government backing these sort of political calculations?
Absolutely. And generally, it's going to be in the service of trying to rally up the base at any point that it seems politically convenient. So if you go back to the 2018 midterms, right? So suddenly what's happening in the country? There's a caravan of migrants coming to the United States, that they're going to be storming the border. We send the military to protect the country. And then the midterm elections are over.
And the caravan disappears.
Right?
Funny that happened.
Yeah. So Trump and the Trump administration knows that for a particular subset of voters, focusing on this issue of immigration is really strategic and effective.
So I think in these comments, we see the playbook that the president will have in his reelection campaign. Let's turn to the other side, which is the Democrats. How, and realizing that we've now got about two dozen candidates, which is a lot of candidates, how will the Democratic Party address white identity and white identity politics?
Or will it?
The group of people that we're talking about.
This is a really difficult question to answer. In fact, if I knew exactly what the answer was, then some political consultants would be paying me a lot of money.
You'd be working for Biden or Warren.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So, I think that part of the answer lies in Democrats not attempting to appeal to this as much, but rather in attempting to try to distract people from these issues that they've been focused on, especially immigration, right? Because we don't actually have an immigration crisis in this country. I mean, we do now in that, we've got all of these people now separated from their families and
camps on the southern
held in
border.
Camps, right? Yeah. So that's part of the crisis. But in terms of, tons of people crossing the border every day, levels of immigration have decreased in years, right? Yep. So we don't actually have an immigration crisis. And yet, if you look at public opinion data, especially split by party, Republicans seem far more concerned about immigration as an issue than they do about almost any other issue in the United States. And so, and certainly a lot of Democrats are worried about that as well. And so I think part of it is turning the American public mind's attention towards other more pressing issues, talking about the economy, talking about things that aren't so divisive, that don't focus so much on white identity politics. The alternative, too, right, is that if the Democrats do want to appeal to these voters, well, the Democrats have been advocating for protecting and preserving and shoring up Social Security and these other social safety nets for a long time. So they could very well, go back to focusing on that. That would be very appealing to this subset of voters.
Since 2016, has white identity increased or decreased in the period that you've been looking at it? Has the Trump presidency had any impact on that pool of Americans?
Yes, and in a way that we ought to be somewhat optimistic about, actually. So what's interesting is that over the period of time, beginning in 2010, all the way till October of 2016, there was really no change in levels of white identity. And then suddenly, in November of 2016, you see about a 10 percentage point drop in levels of identity. Not an increase, but a drop. So what's going on during this period of time? Well, first of all, the media starts using the term white identity politics over and over again. So one funny thing is I've had a Google News alert search set up for the term white identity politics for years. And maybe once a week I'll get one little ping here and there. And now, really since 2016, I get several articles sent into my email inbox almost every single day. But really that shift in the media attention to white identity politics happened almost immediately in November of 2016. And of course, this term starts getting associated with groups like the alt-right, with white supremacists, with the people marching in Charlottesville, right, with tiki torches trying to preserve Confederate monuments. And I think what's happening is that a lot of white people who had this identity but don't want to be associated with white supremacists are saying, no, that's not me. That's not who I want to identify with. So to some extent, Trump has actually pushed a number of people away from this identity.
Almost like it's activated an immune response in the body politic.
Yep.
You looked at gender and white identity, and you came up with a finding that I found somewhat surprising, because I guess the stereotypical image would be it's a white male, mm-hmm, who holds white identity. Tell us what you found.
So, and I don't want to overstate this, but what I often find is that a slightly larger percentage of women adopt this sense of racial identity. And I think that this is kind of an interesting question for future work. It's a little bit of a mystery as to why. There are a couple of hypotheses. So one is that women tend to be more pro-social. We just like to join groups more and associate more with particular social organizations. And so some people argue that whatever identity women might have the potential to adopt, they're more likely to do so than men. The other argument that's, I think, rooted and consistent with a lot of theories in social psychology is that given the choice between different group identities that you might take up, you're more likely to adopt the higher status group. So if women are choosing between their race and their gender, well, their racial identity as a white person is a higher status group in society than their gender. And so that could be part of what's going on as well.
You also came up with, or you used the terms in-groups and out-groups, which I also found interesting. These are terms I had not really heard. Mm-hmm. What is an in-group? What's an out-group?
Yeah, so in-groups are whatever group that you feel that you're a part of, that you have some identification with. And sometimes those are groups that don't hold a lot of meaning to you, but sometimes they can have a tremendous amount of meaning. They can be sort of central to how you see yourself. And so we do this all the time as human beings. We organize and we categorize people into us and them, in-groups and out-groups. It's part of our makeup as human beings. And what social psychologists have found for a long time is that when we do this, we also tend to then develop and adopt a whole set of psychological processes around this sorting. And part of that is that we like to favor our in-groups. We like to have more things for our in-groups. We like to, we see ourselves more positively through our in-groups. We adopt a higher sense of self-esteem. We want to give our group more resources. And oftentimes that comes at the expense of out-groups. That's kind of just it's a very social psychological definition, but it really applies to kind of just how we move about in the world.
We got about a minute left here. I'm curious though if there's any correlation between educational level and white identity.
Absolutely. So whites who went to college are less likely to adopt a sense of white identity. So to the extent that there is maybe a class story here, whites who didn't go to college are more likely to have a sense of identity than whites who did.
So, very quickly, since we are almost out of time, you're working on a new book. Tell us very quickly, I guess in like 15 seconds.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a book with my colleague Spencer Piston at Boston University, and we're interested in the concept of dehumanization. And we're arguing that scientific racism, or this belief that some whites have, that whites are genetically and biologically superior to people of color, particularly blacks in the United States, that's actually far more prevalent among white Americans than people thought before. And if you want to understand criminal justice, policy, support for the death penalty, police brutality, then you have to think about this as an important component.
This is a remarkable set of issues, and Ashley, we thank you for joining us to talk about it. She's Ashley Jardina. The book is White Identity Politics. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.